Kurt Eichenwald is an acclaimed and award-winning investigative journalist for such outlets as the New York Times, Newsweek, and Vanity Fair. His best-selling books include Conspiracy of Fools, 500 Days, and The Informant. He's known for his relentless investigations and exhaustive research. His latest, A Mind Unraveled, a memoir, utilizes the same approach, only this time Eichenwald turns his journalistic lens on himself. A Mind Unraveled is an account of Eichenwald's ongoing struggle with epilepsy. Diagnosed with the disorder as a teenager, he details the abuses he faced while incapacitated post-seizure, the discrimination he fought that almost cost him his education, his employment, and the darkest moments when he contemplated suicide as the only solution to ending his physical and emotional pain. The new book is A Mind Unraveled, a memoir, and it is a pleasure to welcome Kurt Eichenwald. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
At what point did you figure and did you know that it was time and something that you wanted to do to write a memoir and to write about what you had gone through?
Strangely, I don't feel like I've decided that yet, even though I've already done it. You know, in 2010, a bunch of epilepsy organizations got together, and they are spending a lot of time trying to confront the stigma of epilepsy. I mean, it's pretty severe. I mean, we still have large portions of this country that think that people like me shouldn't be allowed to get married. And so their decision was to get people of prominence to come out and say, I have epilepsy, to publicly talk about it. Other than athletes, nobody would. And I'm not, you know, that prominent, but I decided that I have the ability to write a book. Somebody has to do it. And so that was the genesis of this book.
I heard you say in a trailer for the book that the first audience you wanted to reach was the community, the community of those with epilepsy, and then the hope that they would pass it on to general readers who would then understand that community better.
Well, it's actually a much broader goal. I have three. If you want to go to for the most general, this book is about facing severe trauma. There literally is no type of trauma other than war that isn't detailed in this book. The truth is that, you know, in our modern times, people look at trauma as the first step towards victimization, as the step towards inability to go forward. And the trauma I faced, the difficulties I faced, actually became the foundation of strength. It was my commitment to have the life that I've ultimately led. It transformed me. It transformed me into a better person than I otherwise would have been. And so my largest goal in terms of the largest audience would be to say to those who are struggling, who do face challenges, you can overcome them, and they can actually become the basis of living a good life. The epilepsy community was clearly a huge part of this because, you know, epilepsy is still buried in a lot of secrecy. I'm sure there are people in this, you know, listening to this who know people with epilepsy and don't realize it because they haven't been told. And I wanted to communicate to the epilepsy community that, one, you don't have to hide, and two, you can achieve what you want. I, again, had my aspirations and was able to accomplish all of them by utilizing the difficulties I faced as the driving force behind it. And then the other big audience that I'm the big thing I'm hoping to accomplish is public education. It's not the kind of book where it sits down and lectures you. Mm-hmm. It's a narrative. It just tells you the story. But in the course of the story, you find out a lot of things. You find out what having a seizure is like. You find out what the life of someone with epilepsy is like. You find out that, you know, there were people who treated me the right way when I was having massive numbers of seizures, and that was with an attentive disregard. Everybody knew I had epilepsy, but I was not the epileptic. I was not, you know, they were perfectly capable of making jokes about it. I mean, it was not something where, you know, everyone had to walk around in hushed tones and think about it constantly. And then there were people who dealt with it terribly, with fear, with the need to drive me out of their sight. Ultimately, through this, you learn how to deal with a seizure. You learn what epilepsy really is. Hopefully, we start to pass a level where, you know, all of the old wives' tales and fictions get pushed aside and we start actually talking about this in a real way for the 3 million people who have this condition in the United States.
Let us talk for a moment about how you decided to tell this story and how ultimately you were able to tell this story, because you rely heavily on notes, diaries, and remembrances from those of people around you at the time.
There was something I started doing very early on after my diagnosis that I still don't completely understand, which was keeping audio tape diaries. And I would often, almost every day, sit down and record something. And I would talk about what had happened, what was going on, in almost a bizarre level of detail. I think part of it was, you know, I needed someone to talk to who wouldn't ask me why I felt the way I felt. On the next level, you know, the whole essence of epilepsy is loss of control, and being able to put everything down was a form of control. I had left these huge numbers of tapes. I had listened to a few of them at one point, but I had not listened to all of them. And all of them, plus written diaries, plus recordings I asked other people to make, and I decades ago, and I don't know why I did it. But all of that feeds together into becoming the book A Mind Unraveled, and that's how I did it.
Kurt Eichenwald is our guest. Again, the title of the new memoir is A Mind Unraveled. So when it comes to that, I mean, I guess one of the questions, you say you're not quite sure why you did it, but it would seem that it would be both diagnostic, but it would also be therapeutic.
For the audio tapes, there was definitely a therapeutic element to it. I don't know. It just I remember doing it all the time, and it just was good to be able to express just, you know, fear, to express horrible feelings, to express, you know, this is something that happened to me. And there's so much in these tapes, which were horrible to listen to. I could have written another two volumes. I mean, right. This is not all that I talked about. It was, they were exceptionally detailed. I can look back at that now and I can say, in the end, I achieved all my aspirations. You know, I have the job I want. I have the family I want. I've been the kind of husband and father I wanted to be. I'm a very happy person. But the person on those tapes had hopes, but no idea if they would ever be achieved. No idea if he would be dead the next day. Now, I talked a lot about mortality, but not in a self-pitying way. Just, I mean, it's weird. It's something I say to this day. If I were to die tomorrow, I'd be okay with that because I've lived a good life. And back then, that was a theme that came up periodically, was so long as I spend every day living the best life I can, not letting things get past me that could be a moment of full life, if the epilepsy killed me, I would have been okay with that.
You have your first seizure in high school, and then when you're in college, you suffer a concussion. This is a sophomore. And that's really when you start to realize the full effects, right, of the zoning out and the spells.
This is one of the things that I think comes out of the book that people probably don't know, is that there are many kinds of seizures. In fact, there are people inside the epilepsy community who want to call it epilepsies because they seem so different. Going back as far as I could remember, I had these staring spells where I would just disconnect from the world. And when I returned, I wasn't quite sure where I was. And it would take 15, 20 seconds to sort of replace myself. There are times when that was going on where, for reasons I don't know, I was picking at my clothes. That ends up being actually very common with those kinds of staring spells. After the concussion, I had my first, what was then called grand mal seizure, which people think of, convulsions. They're now called tonic-clonic seizures. Ultimately what people normally think of when they hear of an epileptic seizure.
You tell the story in the book about one of the first doctors you see, Dr. Nicholson, who you say exhibited the bedside manner of a termite inspector. At one point, says to you, "Don't start feeling sorry for yourself. There are children dying from cancer, and they're a lot worse off than you. You're not going to die from seizures. Those kids could only wish they had epilepsy." I can't even imagine of that sort of being the starting point, meaning the baseline of how you are to move on with something that has been newly diagnosed.
It took me until I could look back on it and realize how horrific what he had said was. Everything he said in our first meeting, because I wasn't sitting there crying or feeling bad for myself. I actually was relieved when I got the diagnosis of epilepsy because I was afraid I had a brain tumor. And I didn't know what epilepsy meant, but I knew it wasn't a brain tumor. And so I had some questions I wanted to ask, and he was largely ignoring me. He said several things. Don't tell anyone. Because if you do and people find out you have epilepsy, you will be subjected to huge discrimination. You'll lose your friends. Keep secret. Don't call it epilepsy. Call it seizure disorder. He went on to, I don't remember the order of things. It's on the tapes and it's in here. He went on to talk about, don't feel sorry for yourself.
Well, he questioned whether you could deal with a school as tough as Swarthmore.
Oh, yeah. His position was at that point, I wanted to be a lawyer. Well, at that point, I was planning to be a lawyer. I don't know if anybody ever wants to be a lawyer. and I was told, drop those plans. You probably should leave Swarthmore. Too much stress. And don't feel sorry for yourself because there are children dying of cancer. And in the end, I walked out of that. It was almost a perfect storm of complete redefinition of my life. I'd never considered myself as somebody with epilepsy. Him telling me falsehoods like you can't die from it. That's completely wrong. You can die from it. Many people do. All of these forms of what I can only describe as abuse. And that had a horrific impact on me for many, many years.
You were also able to go on, as you say, though. You were able to go on and to finish school and to go on the path that you wanted to go. And those elements of what allowed you to do that and to fight epilepsy and to fight those who were telling you to keep it suppressed, I would think in some way, and I don't mean to overgeneralize this, but it would also set a tone ultimately for your profession, I would think, of becoming the journalist that you became.
You can't actually overstate that. That's absolutely true. There were two elements to my becoming a journalist from my past. One is that I was a telemarketer,
and I learned how to talk to people mm-hmm. on the phone. And the other was rage. You know, I was thrown out of school for my seizures, and I had to fight to get back. I was fired from a job on my first day at work, just hours after they learned that I had epilepsy. I also spoke with other people with epilepsy who had the same thing, but I also came across people, you know, a person with multiple sclerosis who had horrific abuse because of it. As I was dealing with all of these things, I became, you know, obsessed with the concepts of justice. And, you know, I listen to the tapes now, and they're in that period, and they're very philosophical, and they're very caught up in, you know, I just read John Rawls, and I'm going on that path, and I become absolutely obsessed with rage against people of power who abuse people without. That became a driving force. That I didn't plan to become an investigative reporter, but I did, because that's exactly what you're doing. You are discovering people of power who are abusing their position, with the result being that they are harming people who can't fight back. And so I have believed, you know, this is a lot of what I talk about, where, you know, I'm saying that being sick and all these horrible experiences made me who I became. Because without the rage I experienced as a result of people, you know, trying to stop me from being who I wanted to be, trying to stop me from having an education, trying to stop me from having employment, friends, well, people I wanted to be my friends, mm-hmm. who abandoned me when they saw a seizure. You know, all of this, I rarely felt self-pity. Instead, it transformed to rage, and rage transformed to almost an imperative to push forward.
Is the rage gone?
No. The rage, you know, I talk about in the book that it's almost targeted rage. I mean, it's not, you know, flying all over the place anger. It's seeing a circumstance and being insistent that if it's unjust, that I will do something. And makes it sound like, oh, superhero. But no, it's...
No, it makes it sound like you've got quite a job on your hands given today's climate.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, ultimately, that's the thing, is that in today's climate, I don't let go. You know, it's funny. A friend of mine read the book, who is a journalist, a very prominent journalist, and he said, "Now I understand you." Because his point was, he was never able, even though he did a lot of investigative work, mm-hmm. he was never able to get this obsession that I had with, you know, making things right, fighting for the little guy, I guess. And he got it. And he said, "I see where that comes from now." So even people who know me well are reading this and sort of learning to understand things in my character that they didn't quite know where they came from.
And people would use the epilepsy as a way of countering your reporting and questioning it.
It's interesting. There were very, very different ways that people dealt with it. Most of the people, you know, I ended up at one point at CBS News, went on to the New York Times, and lots of people at those organizations knew. They never limited me. They never did anything. I was, in fact, was offered promotions at every organization. And but then on the flip side, there were people every now and then who would come along and say, you know, "Well, you shouldn't be doing this because," and largely the "because" was somebody saying, well, I can't conceive how I would deal with it. And the thing is, before I got sick, I couldn't conceive. You know, you adapt to those things that happen to you. I have challenges, and I'm going to overcome those challenges, and I'm not going to have a sense of victimhood. You know, victimhood is in and of itself surrendering control. I mean, as you might imagine, people with epilepsy are kind of obsessed with control. Mm-hmm. If I feel like a victim, someone has made me feel that way. I'm a victim of someone. And that means you are surrendering control of that element of yourself to whoever is acting in a way you don't like. And I would either fight back or move on. You know, you can look at the past or you can move forward. And those are really your choices. And, you know, we have one life. We don't have the ability to spend 20 years wallowing in self-pity without having wasted our lives. And so that's what I mean when I talk about taking every moment and finding the value in it, you know, whether you're with someone you love or mowing the lawn. Everything has a value. And if you miss that, if instead you surrender all of it to feeling like a victim or feeling sorry for yourself or letting your experiences dominate you, then you've surrendered that one life. Now, I'm not going to sit here and claim that these did not have an impact. I mean, the experiences were horrific. You know, ultimately, I've had to see, I have a PTSD counselor. You know, I mean, I was beaten. I wrote about it, so I'll talk about it. Mm-hmm. I was raped post-seizure. And I faced discrimination. I faced every day thinking I could die. Of course, there is severe traumatic impact from that. I have nightmares all the time, reliving things. You know, but the end point of it is, okay, I could stand back and say, I am so traumatized, but it's like, yeah, I'm traumatized. Now let me go to work. Now let me deal with my kids. Now let me deal with my life. Now let me go and take a deep breath of the air outside. I mean, it cannot be the center of your life.
If one is to Google your name, the first thing that comes up is you and Tucker Carlson. Is that a weird way to think of the thing that sort of rises to the top of the amazing journalistic career you've had? And I mean rising to the top only in the sense of a search engine.
You know, to me, that was such a ridiculous... I mean, Tucker Carlson is a fraud. I mean, I went on his program and he asked me his first question and then the volume in my ear was turned down. I should have said it. I should have said, Tucker, why are you doing this? I should have, you know, he would ask questions while I was speaking in another studio for the purpose of making it look like I'm dodging questions. He did the exact same thing to a conservative named Max Boot. That's why you have a lot of trouble getting anybody on his program anymore, because word has gotten out he's a fraud. His huge level of conservative knuckleheads, and, you know, I'm sorry, there are great, smart conservatives who I respect, and then there are knuckleheads who like to stand in the Coliseum and watch this, you know, battle go on. So they're the ones who made this, I didn't know it was the top thing you find. They're the ones who made that the top thing. And I truly don't care. I mean, you know, it gives me the opportunity to come on a radio program and say Tucker Carlson is a fraud. And, you know, so what's the downside to that?
Well,
Not much.
I see none, no.
And I promise you, the people who made that rise up on the Google search they're not listening to this show. So, you know, they're busy listening to Tucker or Rush or whoever and chuckling away.
So, final question, and it's about how you think, it's a huge question, I'll admit that, but how you then consider and how you think about your job as a journalist, how that has changed, and how the line has changed in this world of, to use a phrase from someone I admire, knuckleheads.
I think that we have hit a very, very dangerous point in this country. You know, I've actually been thinking, if I was as sick as I had been back then and I was setting my aspirations, would I want to be a journalist? And I don't know the answer to that anymore, because journalism is not what it was. Journalism used to be, it's very hard when you do it right. You have to go out. You can't go out saying, here is the point I want to make. I mean, I talk about, you know, raging against power. More times than not, I find the people in power actually didn't do anything wrong. And so those are the stories I don't tell. And, you know, when you get into a situation where you have to challenge what you believe, where you have to really dig into information, you have to pull up a lot of details, you have to read all the reports, you have to talk to all the participants and reach a conclusion. It used to be you would then present that and people would incorporate that into their thinking processes. Now it's you do all of that work, you present something, someone then says, well, I think differently. And that uninformed opinion is as valid in our modern times, is considered as valid as heavily reported information. You know, when you go into what is modern journalism, you know, I stand back and I look at it, and it's come down to, we don't know what knowledge is anymore. We don't understand the difference between knowledge and information, knowledge and facts. Knowledge is complex, and it used to be, in order to get knowledge, you had to read a book or watch a documentary or do something that required you to incorporate lots of facts into and reading somebody who knew what they were talking about to allow you to reach these conclusions. Well, now, you know, I promise you the bestseller in America is Everything You Think Is Right and Those Who Disagree Are Idiots. That's always the bestseller in America. I don't understand why people want to read a book that just says you're right about everything. And now people gravitate towards a television program, a website. I mean, like I said, Tucker Carlson's a fraud, but he gets millions of people listening to him. And they gravitate towards things that just say, you're right, you're right, you're right, you're right, you're right. And here are selected facts to do it. And everyone walks away ignorant, but knowledgeable of facts.
The name of the memoir is A Mind Unraveled. It is published by Ballantine Books. Kurt Eichenwald, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.